You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on September 29th, 2014 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss big ideas in voting security and internet security, as well as the Thai government's food robot. But first, Persephone and I discuss the first female combat pilot in the UAE, Russia's fourth female cosmonaut, and a couple of other stories. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line for a segment from Michigan is Persephone. Persephone, welcome back as always.
Thank you, Bill.
We've got four stories that are semi or not very related, but we're going to kind of put them together in a good news, bad news department. We're going to give you the good news first. So these two things are sort of somewhat closely related. From the United Arab Emirates and from Russia, last week was a big week for women in air and space. I did not anticipate this, but my pretty short post on that on arsenalfordemocracy.com ended up being one of our most popular posts of all time. And that news basically was that the fourth ever female cosmonaut went into space, went to the space station, and that the first ever United Arab Emirates female combat pilot went into action in Syria as part of the airstrikes there. And not only that, but she was actually commanding the missions. So in the story from Russia, Yelena Serova launched into space last week on a Soyuz flight that was taking off from Kazakhstan, went to the space station, and she arrived there and became the first woman in Russia's space program since 1997 to go into space. The last female cosmonaut to do so was Yelena Khondakova. She flew actually on the shuttle Atlantis, you know, sort of one of those joint missions taking off from the U.S., although previously she had done a Soyuz mission. And that was back in May 1997. That was her second space flight. And I was looking into this because some article mentioned, you know, oh, there hasn't been a woman to go into space from the Russian space program since 1997. I was like, that's a really long time. And then I find out that not only that, but she was only going to be the fourth one ever if you include the like Soviet space program, the precursor one to that. And that's the really kind of crazy thing about this is that Russia, or the Soviet Union rather, was so into like Cold War milestones in the space race that they were, you know, oh, we got to get the first man into space, we got to get the first woman into space, etc. They got the first woman into space in like 1963. They didn't put another woman into space until 1982, about a year before the U.S. sent their first woman into space. But in contrast, you know, they've now only gotten up to four between the Soviet and Russian programs for women, whereas the U.S. and all kinds of other countries who participate in these, you know, South Korea, France, etc., they have sent lots of women into space, and there's many, many women in the astronaut program in NASA right now. But Yelena Serova, who is now on the space station, is a real outlier there in the overall history of the Russian program. But, you know, three cheers for her. That's a big milestone, I think. Persephone, did you have any thoughts on this sort of oddly remarkable milestone?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's a great example, right, of tokenization. Like you said, it was purely used as a milestone achievement, and then they decided they didn't really care that much about having women in the space program. But I mean, of course, coming from a U.S. perspective, it's a little difficult to throw stones on that particular one, given that, you know, their second woman in space kind of corresponded with our first woman in space.
Right. So 19 or 20 years later.
Right. So of course, you know, there's an issue going on here with just making this token effort to have women and then just forgetting about it. But I don't think that the 80s space programs were generally a great place for women. But that said, Yelena Serova going into space is a really wonderful thing. And I'm very jealous of her. I'm sure she's doing incredible things out there. And I think it's a really good thing that that she is there. maybe she'll be a forerunner to a new generation of Russian women in space.
Yeah, I certainly hope that this is not, you know, the end of the line again. I wasn't able to really find information on, you know, are there other women in active, you know, training and in position to go into space. But yeah, it was just kind of a startling fact. Another little fun fact before we move on is that Khondakova, who was the previous Russian woman, the only one under the Russian flag to go into space, she is now a member of the Russian Duma, which is the parliament there. She's in, you know, Vladimir Putin's party. Another interesting story in similar, you know, the air and space category, another pioneering one, as I mentioned, is that the United Arab Emirates announced, actually on U.S. television, they were very eager to brag about this, that their first female combat pilot, Major Mariam Al-Mansouri, not only participated in, but actually led the UAE's airstrikes on ISIS positions in Syria. That's part of the U.S.-led coalition that started last week, as I'm sure everyone's noticed. That's with the U.S., Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Jordan. And so the UAE ambassador to the United States went on US TV to confirm this information. She's an F-16 pilot, 35 years old. She said, "I can officially confirm that the UAE strike mission on Monday night was led by female fighter pilot Mariam Al-Mansouri. She is fully qualified, highly trained, combat ready, and she is on the mission." And she's expected to continue leading those airstrikes. And she's actually had been featured in a number of profiles in Emirati media that I was able to find pretty easily just this past year and in the past couple years. She, as I said, she's not only, you know, the first to go into combat, but she was actually the first female participant in the Air Force of the country there, and has been a real, you know, pioneer there. Again, like I said, the government there in this context, very eager to brag about this, partly to take shots at groups like ISIS, but also to take shots at their neighbors, which there's always sort of a competitive rivalry there, even when they're getting along pretty well. So, you know, Saudi Arabia, I believe they've now made it so that they're going to legalize it for women to drive by themselves, but that's been a very long thing, and it's still, that fuse is still burning down there. They haven't actually gotten that, you know, in effect yet. And in contrast, you know, the women in the United Arab Emirates can participate in these various, you know, different activities. There's an increasingly wide range, although still relatively narrow, range of careers that they can pursue. They don't have to wear head coverings, although it tends to be strongly culturally encouraged, certainly. But in general, there is, you know, substantially more freedom in the UAE than in Saudi Arabia. I was lucky enough to meet a number of women in the UAE who were going to college at the same time that I was. You know, a lot of them, they're either working on English degrees or communications degrees and things like that. And, you know, I mean, they're basically very similar to any students, you know, that we were going to school with at the same time in the United States. You know, it's a somewhat different culture, but there's still plenty of opportunities to participate. And actually, there are now two women in the cabinet, the monarchy's cabinet in the UAE. And one of them is in the very powerful position of the foreign trade minister. Some of it is, it's underrepresented, I would say, certainly, but kind of to circle back to that point that you mentioned with the cosmonauts, you know, at least it's not, it doesn't seem to be quite tokenism. Obviously, they're holding her up as a bit of a, you know, token here, but this seems to be like they're willing to put these women into the, you know, powerful, influential positions that they're fully qualified for. And they're overcoming some of the resistance that maybe was there otherwise.
Yeah. And I think that also, although I think it's great that there's so much discussion of this in the U.S., it's also interesting how this, you know, dialogue surrounding this is going. Especially given how recently the United States decided that it was okay to have women on the front lines, right? So there was an incident with Fox News in which they used an expression that cannot be repeated on the air, referring to this woman's anatomy.
Yeah, and the slightly more repeatable offensive remarks were things like jokes about whether or not she could park the plane correctly, which obviously she's an F-16 commander. I think she can handle it. But yeah, no, I was going to touch on that. Like you said, there was that whole thing about women on the front lines, and that was mostly related to things, I think, like the Army and the Marines. But the truly bizarre thing about those offensive Fox News comments was that we've had one of the few combat roles that have been open to women for quite a while now, since I think the early to mid-90s, has been like fighter bomber pilots and crews. So we have like highly decorated, highly respected women who have been flying combat missions in places like Iraq for years now, and yet they're still making jokes like that. Like, this is a totally foreign concept.
Right. And I mean, not that it's any big surprise from that channel, but I think it's pretty disappointing that we have seen that.
There's one other little point that I did want to ask you about on this and get your reaction on. You know, so I mentioned that there had been these women combat pilots in the United States, and you know, maybe that's still not enough, as you say, to get the, you know, to earn their respect, even on Fox News, you know, with its pro-militarism and everything like that. One of the current House candidates on the Republican side for the United States House of Representatives, she actually ran in 2012. It was one of the closest races in the country, finished, you know, with her slightly ahead on election night. And then there were recounts, and it was, you know, within a hundred, you know, a couple hundred votes, basically. And she ended up losing. But she's back again this year in 2014. She's running in, this is the district that Gabby Giffords used to represent, and one of Giffords' old staffers is currently the congressman, Congressman Barber. And she's running against him as a Republican in that district, and she is a combat pilot veteran from the United States Air Force. And she's one of their top prospects to potentially take over a seat from the Democrats. And I say there because, you know, there is sort of a pretty close fusion between the Republican Party and Fox News. So they're simultaneously insulting this, you know, woman from the United Arab Emirates who, as all the profiles said, had to really fight for her right to be able to go to the Air Force Academy there and, you know, get to be a pilot, and then is now being able to fly these missions, you know, on behalf of her country. And they're making fun of her with all these, you know, sexist, crazy remarks or whatever, while they simultaneously have a very well-known, prominent pilot who flew combat missions for the United States who's now running for Congress for the Republicans.
Yeah, I don't think they necessarily would make that connection. I think that actually there's an interesting thing going on in terms of, you know, conservatives, the military, and women, which is that a lot of anti-woman rhetoric that comes from people with quote-unquote traditional values has to do with, well, the problem with women, you know, it's a sort of double-edged thing that goes on, which is that on the one hand, you have this discussion of what a woman's role is, how a woman should be protected, should not be putting herself at risk, should not be getting involved in these violent activities. And then on the other hand, you also get this misogynistic language about how women are dependent on men and they don't do their part. And that's actually more of an MRA thing than a traditional conservative argument, but you get tons of arguments about how, well, you know, the Titanic, you know, women and children first, men always have to be the ones to die. And this is used not as a, let's make sure we have equal access for women in more dangerous careers, but as a reason to be anti-woman in other regards. Like, you know, why should women have equal pay when they don't do dangerous jobs, which is because they're not allowed to do dangerous jobs. But so it's this interesting sort of dynamic that goes on where women in dangerous roles, on the one hand, that's seen as wrong, but on the other hand, women are blamed for not participating in these dangerous roles. In terms of this candidate,
Colonel McSally.
In terms of Colonel McSally, I think that probably she's seen as okay because, you know, she's out there protecting the country or whatever, you know. And so for that reason, it's all right because, you know, she's fighting for the U.S. And so they're probably going to just use that same rhetoric, whereas this is a woman from another country. So even if she's fighting, you know, against ISIS, there's sort of a, well, why do we care attitude? And it returns to the whole, you know, this isn't a woman's role thing.
Right. And the other just fascinating, like, you know, how these things all seem to overlap. So Martha McSally, the U.S. Air Force colonel that we were just talking about, she actually became famous within the relatively narrow ranks of the women flying combat missions because she ended up getting into a lawsuit after significant complaints. She got into a lawsuit with the U.S. Defense Department because there was a sort of strange rule that said that if you were traveling off base in Saudi Arabia from one of the air bases in Saudi Arabia, that you had to be accompanied by a man who would pose as your husband and you had to keep your head covered. And you might think, oh, well, that's just complying with the, you know, Saudi Arabian laws or whatever. As it turned out, and as she pointed out in the thing, the State Department regulations specifically said that anyone representing the State Department rather than the military in Saudi Arabia, including in the capital, they were representing, you know, as women, they were representing American women and, you know, the American government, and they should not have to dress like that because it was considered to be, you know, that they, you know, they wouldn't have to do that in the U.S., so they shouldn't have to do it there, which, I mean, you can get into arguments back and forth about that, but at least the standard within the government should be consistent, and it wasn't, and she didn't feel like she should have to cover her head and have some guy lie about being her husband or something for her to travel off base when, you know, they didn't have any rules like that for the State Department. So, you know, all of this, you know, sort of circling around, you know, back and forth. But I just thought that it was just fascinating slash disturbing the way that this was handled. But in general, I think that most of the coverage, you know, Fox News aside, has been quite positive. But yeah, so congratulations to Major Al-Mansouri and the cosmonaut Yelena Sarova for their milestones that they hit this week in for women in air and space, and hopefully we'll see, you know, more progress on those fronts as well. So turning now to the bad news, Persephone, you were going to introduce those topics a little bit and walk us through what you've been seeing.
Yeah, so listeners who take contraceptives may already be aware that under the Affordable Care Act, you don't have to pay a copay for some forms of birth control medication. Unfortunately, about 11,000 women have been charged a copay trying to get their birth control at CVS pharmacies. According to CVS, this is because of a coding error that is going to be fixed. But whatever the reason, the end result is that these people have been paying copays on medication that should have been completely free for them, that the insurance company should have covered the cost of. Now, this is an issue that has to do with just in general the transitions going on with the Affordable Care Act. It seems like, given that some of these pharmacists were asking women for a copay and not saying, hey, something's funny here, it sounds like there's also an issue here of communication between the law and the people who are applying the law in some form, that these pharmacists apparently were not aware that there's no copay for birth control. Bill, what's your take on it?
Yeah, well, again, like you said, I mean, they're claiming that this was some sort of mix-up or that something was mislabeled or whatever, but, you know, at the scale that we're looking at here, it should have been pretty uniform that you just tell all your employees, like, all right, remember, we don't charge copays anymore for generic contraception. It's all going to be paid for by the insurance company. And instead, they were just collecting the money anyway and pocketing it. And, you know, we know at least 11,000 women were affected, but possibly a lot more. And this, I mean, it's not like this was a low profile aspect of the Affordable Care Act. Yeah, that was a complicated piece of legislation, but I think that this is one of the ones that got the most attention. You know, aside from some of the more banal but uncontroversial ones, relatively uncontroversial ones, like people being able to stay on their parents' health insurance until age 26 and stuff like that, this is one of those ones that it's like, well, okay, this caused a lot of controversy. People got all upset. You know, then there was the whole debates over whether the employers had to provide it. Like, all these things put it in the news. So this should have been a relatively easy one to change, and it's kind of weird that you didn't have the CVS employees at a minimum going, hey, wasn't this supposed to be no copays anymore? Wasn't that supposed to change or something like that? So it's sort of a little bit mystifying as to how at that level it managed to be sort of skipped over.
Yeah, I think this is also a good lesson because it shows that there is some sort of either lack of communication or something going on where this incredibly high profile, as you said, piece of legislation, the message just didn't get across to pharmacy staff somehow. And another part of this is that Congresswoman Jackie Speier, who is the San Francisco, San Mateo County's representative, has been getting involved in this. She sent a letter to the CEO of CVS, Larry J. Merlo, to let them know about this error, which is sort of unfortunate. You know, a representative had to get involved in this because people were getting charged copays. And I guess given that people had complained to the congresswoman, it seems that people were aware of this problem and probably tried other means, such as contacting CVS directly, and just didn't get responses.
And Congressman Jackie Speier, as Persephone mentioned, is the one who brought this to everyone's attention. She's running again for re-election this year against Robin Chu in that district in Northern California on the general election ballot. I wanted to talk now about another story, and I'll let Persephone introduce this as well. But I think that it's a good kind of example of, we talk a lot about contraception and access to safe abortion and other reproductive freedom options. We talk about that a lot on this show. And sometimes it can be a little bit abstract in the United States, although we've been pointing out that it's been getting increasingly hard to access some of these services, even in parts of the United States. But, you know, we often say if these options aren't available, the alternatives are inevitably worse and more dangerous. And this particular story from a different country is going to be kind of an example that confirms that, in my opinion anyway. Persephone, why don't you let us know what the situation in Kenya is right now?
Basically, what just happened in Kenya is that a nurse, Jackson Namunya Tali, has been sentenced to death after a young woman, a teenager, died as a result of a failed abortion procedure. Now, the prosecution argued that Namunya had performed the abortion and that he was essentially, that his performance of the abortion resulted in her death. And to them, it was also relevant that the fetus died. But he argued that he had just tried to help her after she came to him, already having tried to have the procedure performed. So abortion is illegal in Kenya unless the mother's life is in danger, which is why Namunya is now facing the death penalty for this. I think it's also interesting to look at this situation, not only in terms of the obvious dangers of getting an abortion when it's not legal, in terms of hygiene and just in terms of where you get it done, because it's not necessarily going to happen in a hospital, and it's not necessarily going to happen at the hands of somebody who's trained in abortions. But I think it's also interesting to look at the market that develops. Now, I don't know what the situation is with the nurse who is being given the death penalty. I don't know whether he's somebody who regularly performed, you know, undercover abortions. I don't know how that worked. And it's entirely possible that he knew her and he wanted to help and it was something like that. But there's also a danger in these situations that somebody who is completely unqualified and has absolutely zero medical experience will then try to claim they have more knowledge than they do and overcharge somebody for getting an incredibly unsafe medical procedure. So I think that that's also important to talk about when we're talking about situations where abortion is made illegal.
Right. Now, Kenya does have, like, you know, 44 million people or whatever, and probably at least half, if not more, of those are women. So, you know, in this context, it doesn't maybe seem like a huge number, but according to the BBC, 120,000 Kenyan women are treated annually for complications from failed attempts to obtain abortions illegally in the country. I mean, if you want to talk about a market emerging, that is a testimony right there that that's, you know, that that has definitely emerged. And we don't know what the number is of people who either go untreated or don't develop complications, but it's got to be higher than that. And, you know, they did kind of relax the abortion law slightly. Previously, you had to get three different doctors to sign off that the, you know, the health of the mother was in danger. Now it's just one, but as we know, that can be one too many in many cases. And, you know, there are other reasons as well. And obviously, like we've said before, the best solution would be to have more, you know, contraceptive options available and family planning services and counseling and things like that. But, you know, there needs to be that last line of defense, and that last line of defense needs to be safe. And this is, you know, clearly not safe. But it's also just kind of crazy that they're taking the, you know, maybe they did manage to prove that he was responsible for it. Maybe, you know, his defense is not correct. But he's being sentenced to death by hanging, and no one has been executed in Kenya since 1987. So they're rolling out the big guns, so to speak, on this particular case, when clearly this is being provided to other women. And, you know, maybe they're not dying, but this suggests that they are. And for whatever reason, he's the one who's getting put as the example to send a message.
Yeah, I think it's just a really terrible situation all around on this one. You know, just everything from the details of the case to the fact that the young woman, whose name is Christine Atieno, died, to the fact that abortion is illegal in the first place and that this death could have been prevented had she had safe and affordable access to abortion.
And there seems to be, as within the United States, there's a large religious lobby in Kenya that was responsible for preventing attempts to reform and liberalize the existing laws there. All right, well, Persephone, thank you so much for joining me to talk about these issues. Obviously, some of them were a little bit darker than others, but they're sort of a roundup of things that I found interesting from around the world, and I hope you did as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.